I'm Kathy Forst, music director at Casey Cafe Radio. We're very happy to have singer-songwriter Robert Dale Klein as an artist on Casey Cafe Radio. We're proud to be playing songs from his album This Side of the Dirt on the station. Robert recently had a very successful sold-out album release and is finding a lot of success on the charts with the new album. Robert Dale Klein is a musical storyteller, reminiscent of such greats as Johnny Cash and Kris Kristofferson. His songs are about life, death, and everything in between. Thanks so much, Robert, for taking the time to talk with me today here on Casey Cafe Radio.
Well, good morning, Kathy. I'm delighted to be here.
I mentioned in the intro about your record release for This Side of the Dirt. Tell me about that and who all was there.
Well, I'm so thrilled about the record release. It just happened a week or so ago. It took place at the Soundry, which is a hip new venue in Columbia, Maryland, which is midway between Baltimore and Washington and draws from the Baltimore-Annapolis DC triangle, the whole metro area. It was sold out, which holds, the venue holds about 200 people. And I'm sure that was due in no small part to the fact that I had some wonderful guest artists who are longtime friends of mine, who are also co-writers, not the least of which is the wonderful Dan Navarro, with whom I have co-writes on two of the songs on the album, Borrowed Time, which just made number 4 in the top 10 chart on KC Cafe Radio, I'm delighted to say, this past weekend, and also on the song She Dreams in Music. My other special guests were Jennifer Ferguson-Smith and Scott Smith of the wonderful acoustic pop duo Naked Blue, who currently are touring the country with mega best-selling author Lee Child, who's the creator of the Jack Reacher series of books. And Lee Child and my friends Jen and Scott just released, a couple days after my album release party, they released in New York their new album called Just the Clothes on My Back, which are some songs based on the Jack Reacher character. I was in New York to support them for their record release as well. Also, I had a special guest, David Fennessy, singer-songwriter, formerly of the group Stone Honey. And plus, we had a full band behind us. So by the end of the night, when we had all hands on deck, including myself, there were 10 of us on stage at the Soundry. It was a great night. I'm very excited. It was everything I had hoped it would be, and then some.
Wow, that sounds cool. Yeah, I just saw Dan Navarro at Far West about a month ago, I guess now.
Yeah, Dan gets around. He's a pal. He's a frequent guest in our home in Annapolis, where my wife and I live, and he's a bud.
Mm-hmm. How did you get to know Dan?
It started out about 25 years ago, when Dan and Eric Lowen were touring, beginning their careers as Lowen and Navarro. And although they're from L.A., the Annapolis area is really where they got their start, the kind of the Annapolis D.C. corridor. They got some airplay on one of the local radio stations here, and this was back in the days of Walking on a Wire, their first release. And so it started out as being a fan of theirs, and in that time, in those days, I was in an acoustic trio, and we used to cover some of their songs. In fact, included our cover of Walking on a Wire on a demo tape that we used to use to get gigs. And so I gave Dan a copy of that tape years and years ago, and that's kind of how we started to get to know each other. And as the years went on, we would see each other at various songwriter events. I am a coordinator of the Washington, D.C. chapter of the Nashville Songwriters Association, and through NSAI events, particularly in efforts to lobby in Congress, I would run into Dan from time to time. And then several years ago, we met and spent a long weekend together at a songwriting retreat hosted by my friends Jen and Scott Smith of Naked Blue that took place in Maryland. And that was really the beginning of our friendship as opposed to fanship between Dan and me. And eventually got to the point where Dan said, we should write songs together. And that was music to my ears, and so we did.
Yeah, that's awesome that, you know, you can take that relationship from being a fan into being friends and co-writers. How did you, like, approach him about co-writing these songs with you?
Well, I didn't approach him. I mean, I viewed myself as the junior partner in that relationship. And one thing I learned a long time ago in my many trips to Nashville is that Yeah, you don't. It's poor etiquette to ask, you know, a hit songwriter, you know, can I write with you? Mm. And so it was actually the other way around. Dan proposed that we write, and that was one of the happy days of my life.
Yeah.
And so we did, and we wrote, and it was, you know, we had good chemistry, and we the songs we've written together, I'm very proud of. Of course, I asked him if it was okay if I included the two songs that are on the album because if he was intending to cut them, you know, I didn't want to step on that. Because he, for example, the song She Dreams in Music, which I'm not sure is in the songs I've released to radio yet, I can't remember. that one, Dan will, when he comes to town, will often perform and generously calls me up on stage to accompany him and sing mm-hmm. with him. Whereas the song Borrowed Time, its first performance was at the record release concert. And the main reason for that is it has this incredibly complicated guitar riff that neither Dan nor I can play. It's hard to, it's like walking and chewing gum and rubbing your tummy and patting your head. It's a lot to, you know, you have to be focused on guitar playing and not singing mm-hmm. in order to pull it off. So with a full band behind us, it was actually our closing song of the night because it's quite a rocker.
Yeah, and that's a great song on there. So when you go to a co-writing, you know, you sit down to co-write with somebody, do you come to the table with an idea, or do you come, let's just see what we can flesh out here between the two of us?
It's always good to come with an idea. So, and Chris, I've co-written with all kinds of people over the years in a variety of settings, one-on-one, you know, three people in a room, four people in a room, which is tough. But I always try to come to the table with something. I think it's true of most people who write a lot of songs, is we all carry around, either electronically or in paper form or both, title ideas. And mm-hmm. I mean, I'm always writing down the idea of a title that I might be able to do something with. And it might, I use the software Master Writer to just keep track of my ideas. And so often I'll just put a title that I think, oh, I'm like, this might be cool to write to. And I'll even sketch out a note or two about what I envision I might do with this title. Because I look for things that might have double meanings, you know, things that I could put a twist in. I guess that's my country writing influence there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can talk about specific songs, how they came about, but generally, I think it's always good to have something in your hip pocket.
Right. You just mentioned that, what was the software you use for your...
Oh, Master Writer is a software that I find very helpful. It's basically, it's a database for keeping, for tracking ideas, but also for developing ideas. And it's specifically designed for songwriters. And it has the most amazing electronic rhyming dictionary and phrase dictionary and popular imagery, and it has a lot of features that make it very fast and efficient to work.
Wow. I need to look that up.
It's quite powerful, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah, because whenever I'm writing, I always go into, you know, the computer. I'm like, okay, what's another word for this, you know, because, you know.
Oh, yeah. It also has this thesaurus in mm-hmm. built in, and you just click on the word you want to explore, whether you're trying to rhyme it or find phrases that use it, either any beginning or end or middle of a phrase. Or synonyms for it. It's very, very fast and powerful. And it's, you know, because I used to sit around going, all right, what rhymes with boy? And then I go, right. Boy, joy, hoy. Yeah, you know, I go down the alphabet.
Yeah, you write out the alphabet and you like, right. Okay, what is it?
Well, this, and not only will it find perfect rhymes, but it'll find near rhymes, and, mm-hmm. and you can specify the number of degrees of width or departure, if you will, from a perfect rhyme. And you can also specify, you know, I'm looking for a two-syllable word that rhymes with happenstance.
That sounds like a great tool. Well, I have to look that up for sure. Because mm-hmm. I, you know, a lot of times I get stuck on a song, and it's usually because of that kind of thing. It's like, I can't find a good rhyme for this, you know.
Yeah, so well, the other thing I try to avoid when writing songs initially is I try to get the ideas out first and worry about rhyming second. Because mm-hmm. I know at the end of the day, I can always find a rhyme. If I can't, then I've painted myself into a corner in terms of vowel sounds, and then maybe I should not use it. Maybe I should use a synonym for the word that I'm trying to rhyme.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You recorded this album where?
I recorded the album in Nashville at the Butcher Shop Studios, which is a funky old studio. It's an iconic place where Johnny Cash has recorded, Kris Kristofferson's recorded. In fact, Kris Kristofferson signed the door that separates the control room from the tracking room. So wow. It's an inspiring place to be. Yeah. And it was suggested by my producer, Phil Madeira of Nashville, who's Emmylou Harris's keyboardist.
Right. Yeah. He's been doing a lot of producing lately.
Phil's a great guy. I mean, I was just chatting with him last night. He's producing a lot for others, plus his own fine work as an artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He just did a Sobo, I think, or he worked with them recently,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. My friend Chuck McDowell. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just was with Chuck. We were at a songwriting retreat in Maine in October, Chuck and I.
Oh, very cool. That'd be a great place to go for a songwriting retreat. So how did you get to work with Phil Madeira?
Well, I knew who Phil was from my frequent trips to Nashville, seeing him perform either as a sideman for artists I was there to see during Tin Pan South in Nashville, or he was hosting song rounds of himself and other artists during Tin Pan South. So I knew who he was, and I met him several years ago at the same songwriting retreat where I kind of reunited, if you will, or got to really know Dan Navarro. And I got to know Phil on that trip because he flew into BWI Airport, Baltimore, Washington International, which is about a half hour from my home driving wise, and the retreat was about a 3-hour drive away from the airport. So I volunteered to pick him up, knowing who he was. Mm-hmm. And we bonded on that trip down to Crisfield, Maryland, which is in the southernmost part of the eastern shore of Maryland, where we were all ensconced for a weekend of songwriting. And then I drove Phil back at the end of that trip. So that was the beginning of our relationship. And then Phil, over the years, has been a guest in my home. And he also hosts songwriting retreats known as the Mercyland Retreats. And so several times a year, I'd be in his good company for that. And he and I have also written together in one-on-one settings down in Nashville.
That's awesome.
In fact, one of the songs that Phil and I wrote called Rain, mm-hmm, is on the album, also made it into the top 10.
Yeah,
One Year Station.
Yeah, I like that one too. Yeah, we'll get talking about some of the songs here a little bit later. When you work in Nashville, you know, he's bringing in some of his cohorts in the Red Dirt Boys. Do you find it intimidating to be in the studio with some of those people?
Well, it could be intimidating, but for the fact that they are all so nice and welcoming. Certainly, I've been writing songs my entire life, which is decades. But this is the first time, I guess, I had the nerve or the confidence, if you will, to release an album of my work. And so, I guess I went in certainly intimidated by the fact that I'm surrounded by all these pros, but also with enough self-confidence in my own abilities as a writer and a performer to at least figure, you know, well, they're human, I'm human. we all put our pants on in the morning, or our dresses, mm-hmm, or whatever it is, depending on, there are also women involved in this project. Mm-hmm. And so what do I have to lose? Plus, I'm used to standing up in church and singing in front of 500 people every week for the last 50 years. So I'm used to performing.
Yeah. So you just mentioned that this is like your first time you've actually put your own music out on a CD. Why did it take you this many years?
I think partially it was maybe getting to a point where I felt like I had something really worth sharing, mm-hmm, that my craft had developed to the point where I wasn't embarrassed by it. And I don't know. Maybe it's just the time of life. I saw it as a legacy thing, and for my kids, and now I have a grandchild. something for them to remember Dad and Grandpa by. Not that I plan to go on going anywhere in terms of leaving this side of the dirt, but while I can, and also it's expensive, you know. And I've, you know, I've fortunately, my day job has been good to me, and I could afford to do this and do it right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just talking with another singer-songwriter the other day, and we were talking about, you know, the beautiful thing about being an artist is that you can leave a legacy behind, you know. You can leave your songs behind that people can hear, and they'll get, they'll, you know, generations from now, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren are going to get to know who you were as a person because they hear your music and kind of get a glimpse into the kind of person you were, so...
Well, one would hope. I've been spending some time in recent years, months, I should say, on Ancestry.com. You know, they say that you live as long as the last person who says your name. And what got me focused on that was I discovered a relative from Ireland that I didn't know existed way back in the family tree from the mid-1700s. And it just got me thinking about legacy, although this was after I'd already decided to make the album, but I guess it's just indicative of things on my mind in the last few years.
Yeah. Speaking of, you know, what's come before, I saw in your bio that the Beatles are a major influence for you.
And me and the rest of the world.
Exactly. Yeah. They were an influence for me as well. Who else were some of your inspirations?
Well, I would say the Beatles were the ones that got me interested in playing music. But once I started playing music, I certainly was drawn initially to two very different idioms. One is the folk scene, and the other was Broadway tunes. I think that was an influence of some of my relatives, and I love both. And I've written actually in the various genres, but I started out on guitar, really kind of learning folk songs, you know, Peter, Paul, and Mary, New Christy Minstrels. As I got more better at guitar, you know, Simon and Garfunkel, Paul Simon was a huge influence. James Taylor, huge. Crosby, Stills, and Nash, huge influence on me. And then in terms of lyric content, people like John Prine, Christofferson, Cash, the kind of the storytelling songwriting. I became interested in that and the idea of making little three-act plays in three and a half minutes. So although I kind of started in the initially drawn to, you know, the Beatles were pop, I quickly became more lyric focused as I guess matured as a writer. Not that I still love the Beatles, don't get me wrong, but and I also love U2 in terms of modern groups. They're probably the biggest modern group that I'm a fan of. And the Eagles, I like them.
Yeah. So did you come from a musical family then?
Not really. My dad could sing. I'm German-Irish. Both are singing cultures. And my dad was kind of an Irish tenor. And I range vocally from baritone to the lower tenor range. And somewhere along the line, I discovered I could sing and eventually taught myself how to play the guitar. And then when I was in college, I taught myself how to play the piano because I was the eldest of seven kids in this German-Irish family, and there was no money for lessons, so it was self-help.
So nobody else took up an instrument as well, and your brothers and sisters? Or
No, they didn't. They all play a mean stereo, but that's about it. Now, my daughter, she played piano and flute. My boys, I have twin boys, identical twin boys, in fact, who they were in their grade school band, one playing a wind instrument and the other banging on drums, but they quickly realized that they had inherited the deeply recessive jock gene from their dad, and they are natural athletes. They're much bigger than me, so their attention turned to sports, but they're huge supporters of my music, and they both live on the West Coast now. They're married. One lives in Seattle, one lives in San Francisco with their respective wives, but because they do support their dad, they each flew to Maryland for my record release concert to surprise me.
Oh, that's beautiful. So. That's wonderful. It's good to have that family support.
It sure is.
Yeah. You started playing guitar then about what?
Well, I was a teenager.
So what point did you start writing your own songs then?
As a teenager. Initially, course, none of them were good. I started writing parody songs. This was in, you know, Weird Al Yankovic wasn't around, but Alan Sherman was. Mm-hmm. So my best friend and I, we used to like to just, you know, write comedy songs using other people's melodies, and we would just, you know, make funny lyrics to them. And then I started writing a little bit in high school and college, my own stuff, when I realized that it wasn't illegal to write your own stuff. And then as I got older, I just started writing more and more. And certainly the last 15 years, I would say, since the early 2000s, it's like somebody, you know, set off a keg of dynamite in terms of my output. I'm not, you know, written hundreds and hundreds of songs over the years, but certainly, you know, I write a lot now. It's just 'cause I, you know, now that my kids are grown, I also have more time.
Yeah, it's funny how that happens. The older they get, the little bit more free time. The worry goes up a little bit more, but the free time gets better. So,
yeah.
Do you remember the first song you wrote?
Well, I don't remember the first funny one. The first serious one I wrote was a lullaby for the daughter of a good friend of mine named Ariel. It was called Lullaby for Ariel.
Nice. So did you ever write on the piano as well, or is piano just an
instrument? No, I do write on the piano. I write differently on the piano. I think it's, and most people that I know who are, you know, multi-instrumentalists will say that, and who are also songwriters, will say that they write differently depending on the instrument they're playing. I think it has to do with the way you attack songs. A lot, if you notice, a lot of guitar players, when they sing, the words will come after the downbeat, and piano players, for whatever reason, tend to put the first lyric word on the downbeat. Now, that's not a hard and fast rule, but it's something that I and others have noticed.
I have not. That's a really interesting
thing. And you can also do things on, at least I can on piano, that I can't do on the guitar, in terms of, you know, you can, with the left hand of the piano, you can create a moving bass line that you should, I can do that on guitar, but you can get more interesting chord inversions, at least I can, out of a piano than on a guitar. And I think maybe it has to do with the fact that a piano is laid out in a linear fashion, so I know all the high notes are to my right and all the low notes are to my left.
Whereas
on a guitar, it depends on where you are on the neck and what string you're on. It's a little more confusing.
Right.
For me at least.
Yeah, and with guitar, you can play middle C in five different places, where on piano, there's only one middle C.
Right. So. Although, I'm probably a better guitar player than I'm a piano player, when I write on piano, I can write things that are more in a movie theme or Broadway-ish, showy, a kind of adult contemporary, whereas I'll be more folky or rocky or
country,
alternative country. Yeah, country, yeah, for sure, on guitar.
Yeah. So you mentioned Broadway again. So what are some of your favorite Broadway musicals? Because I love Broadway musicals as well. I just wonder.
Well, my very first, this is probably not a good confession for a healthy male to make, but the very first record I ever bought, LP I ever bought with my own money, was My Fair Lady.
Oh, that's a great one.
I love British culture. In fact, I spent my junior year abroad in England. And so I loved Rex Harrison. I used to be able to sing that record with a British accent forward and backwards. Camelot, and, you know, Hair. I mean, very different things. More modern, you know, it's all certainly, you know, Les Mis, I mean, very different. Phantom of the Opera. So I loved anything that Anthony Newley and Leslie Bricus did. The Smell of the Grease Paint, The Roar of the Crowd, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, Camelot. I tried to, when my daughter, who was our firstborn, introduce her, she was growing up, with all the great Broadway classics by giving her, instead of LPs, she was getting CDs of all these great musicals.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you mentioned you also write a little bit of Broadway kind of style stuff. What have you written for that song?
Well, gosh, there's nothing that I've recorded. Well, actually, I think this might qualify. It's not quite Broadway, but it's definitely maybe more movie thematic. It's a song on the album called Thank You, which I wrote with my friend, a great singer and writer, Donna Britton Bukevich. That song is the theme song to a film called From Grief to Gratitude, which is based on a book by the same name. And Donna and I wrote that on spec. She knew the producer of the film, and you know, I read the book and got some ideas about what might support that movie in terms of a theme song. And so I composed the music for that using chord changes that are not typical. Certainly, they're not country and whatnot. Mm-hmm. They're very different. And we recorded a demo of that with me playing piano and Donna, who's a killer vocalist, singing it. And that's the version they used in the film, was our demo. And Donna has recorded a version that I actually haven't heard yet. It's on her new album that I need to pick up. She just released it. And I had recorded the version that's on my album, which I interpreted, well, I have to really, my producer, Phil Madeira, interpreted purposefully, quite different from the take on it that Donna and I did, which was more straightforward. It was just piano, vocal, ballad, if you will, and more dramatic. Whereas we put a more energetic, almost like Louisiana, New Orleans style patina to it. And it ends up very gospel-y by the end of the song, which in itself was a happy accident, which I'll tell you about if you want to know.
yeah, please.
Well, all right, well, we recorded that song in the butcher shop, and we had finished the song, a long held note at the end with Phil Madeira on organ, and just this organ note ringing out, and the tape was still running, or I use the word tape, the Pro Tools was still running, and Will Kimbrough from Emmylou's band, who's Emmylou's lead guitar player and who's on my record, he turned around in the studio and accidentally banged into one of his guitars, and it made this raucous sound, which triggered the drummer, Dennis Holt, who's in the ISO booth where the drums were, to play this double time beat. And these guys, you know, they're playing together all the time, right? So it was spontaneous combustion. Somebody lit a match to a stick of dynamite, and these guys just started, exploded instrumentally. And it was the coolest groove. So the tape, you know, was still running. So I said, keep that. And so later in the week, when we're doing overdubs, we had Cindy Morgan, who's a wonderful, wonderful artist. She was doing all the female backing vocals on the record. We had her come in like scat sing over the end of that record. So it's this very joyful, raucous, gospel-y thing at the end. So I get the mixes back finally. A couple months later, and I'm listening to it, and I thought, this is because we kept that we got rid of the guitar being banged into, but we that got spliced onto the end as a surprise ending or second ending. So I'm listening to it, and it sounds like the song's over. Bob Klein's left the stage and got in his limo, and the band's on stage still performing. So I said, and this is the final track of the album. I thought, well, this can't do. I said, first of all, Bob, I don't want to leave any impression that I've got a limo and that I'm going to abandon my band. So I overdubbed my own vocal in my home studio on top of Cindy's vocal on that scat thing. So that's how the ending of the surprise ending, the second ending of that song came to be. Really, my happy for God, it was a happy accident.
Yeah,
and that's the way when we did this song at my record release show, that's the way we did it. We played the false ending, and then we exploded into this big, big ending.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's amazing how things can just, you know, organically happen like that, just in the studio, and create this incredible sound. That's so cool. So when you're writing, is it a formula for you? Is it music comes first or lyric comes first, or do you they happen at the same time? Or
I try to mix it up. If I had to do a statistical analysis, I would say for me, I usually start with a title and an idea of what I can do with that title. And then I will write out phrases. I try not to rhyme. I mentioned this earlier. I try to just brain dump phrases, ideas, images, anything to create raw material that I might then assemble and then polish and make rhyme in an effort to develop. And I also try to sometimes, it depends on the song, but also try to write out what I envision happening in each verse in terms of making the story progress. And I'll start singing phrases, sometimes without an instrument, just trying to figure how might this sound melodically and experiment with different melodies. Sometimes with a guitar, a lot of times with an instrument, but sometimes that can be limiting. And so I try to also, whether I start out with an instrument or not, when I'm applying melody, I also try to at least make sure I try things without an instrument so I'm not locked in, because I might come up with a different phrasing that might be more interesting in terms of where the beats fall, where the accents fall. So there's not a formula. There's certainly a process in which I try to be mindful of a lot of different factors. And mostly I try not to paint myself into a corner by rhyming too early.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good advice on songwriting, I think, right there. When you write, do you write with someone in mind, or you have like a, are you writing for yourself? You ever think about, oh, this would be a good song for, you know, someone else to do?
I would say when I first started kind of being schooled in the Nashville way, I would try to write with a style of an artist in mind, thinking, oh, maybe I'll get a cut. And as time has marched on, I've decided that given the way that the music business has gone, the market, the fact that I don't like a lot of what I hear on modern country radio.
Me too.
In terms of the songs, I mean, the artists are all, you know, they're all very super uber talented. I just don't care for the subject matter. It's kind of trite, a lot of it. I mean, that's not saying there aren't some killer great songs coming out of Nashville but it's just the way the market is going. You know, I'm not a 20 something anymore, and I just don't relate to that stuff. And so I'm thinking, you know, who am I kidding? I'm gonna write for me. And now I've got to the point in life where I'm about to retire from my day job and spend my time full time on music and being a performing, or, you know, regularly performing artist. At least that's what I hope to do. I'll do house concerts. I'll look for venues that'll have me. I used to, for years, did the bar gig scene doing covers, which, you know, had its place in my life. Learned a lot about songwriting by playing great songs. But I'm not interested in that anymore. I don't want to be in the background. I don't want to be Muzak in an elevator, which is what most playing in most bars is these days.
Yeah, you can't really do original stuff anymore, really.
Well, that's it. So I look for writer showcase opportunities. And, you know, other than that, I'll spend my time in other ways. I still love the creative process, so I find ways to. And I guess, and I certainly have a big musical outlet for me right now, at least in terms of just performance, is I direct the contemporary music group at my parish church. So I play every week, so I keep my chops up, even though I'm not necessarily singing. Although I do write for, you know, contemporary Christian music as well. That's not where my energies are focused. And so mostly I'm, you know, doing other people's music at church, but at least it keeps my skill set up in terms of live performance.
Right. Yeah. So that's interesting that you actually write contemporary Christian too, because that's very different from what you perform on this album.
If you notice the song The Maker's Mark,
right,
which uses drinking imagery, but it also uses a lot of religious imagery in the context,
right, and it talks about a church and all that in the song.
So I've met, and or the song Rain certainly has contemporary Christian influence, I would say, even though it's, you wouldn't say it's a Christian song, right, per se.
Yeah, so a lot of those images kind of filter through to your right, more secular, yeah, things.
Right, exactly.
What inspires you to write a song? You were talking about that, you know, a lot of times it comes from a title, or what kind of grabs you for like a title? What kind of, you see, you hear something, you're like, that would be a good song. What makes you think that?
I guess somebody said, how do you define obscenity? I know it when I see it, you know, and I guess it's that with cool song titles, you know, maybe they won't strike somebody else as cool, but I mean, you take The Maker's Mark, for example, that was inspired by actually a bottle of Maker's Mark whiskey that we mentioned, our mutual friend Chuck McDowell of Isobo. Mm-hmm. Chuck and I were at a writer's retreat together, and he walks in with this gigantic crowd-sized bottle of Maker's Mark. I had never seen Maker's Mark before, much less tasted it. And this was like a four-day retreat, but with about 15, 16 writers. By the end of that retreat, the bottle was empty. I had tasted Maker's Mark. I now refer to it as songwriting juice. And I couldn't get that image out of my head when I came home from that writer's retreat. And so I thought, oh, The Maker, oh, I can write a song about this. Mm-hmm. And that song just flowed. And it was all inspired by that bottle and the idea that you know, it has a double meaning, the, yeah, Maker's Mark.
Yeah, and I never even thought of that until I heard that song, and I'm like, wow.
You know, other songs are driven by life events. I mean, Hey St. Peter, for example, on the album, that was, you know, there's a stage of life where, you know, you have friends older and younger who pass away. I mean, it's, you know, that's a common thing in all of our lives, and just happens with increasing frequency, sadly. And you know, I've lost a number of friends in recent years, and I guess that was on my mind. And I was having a conversation with St. Peter in that song about someone who could be a friend of any of us. Mm-hmm. I tried to make the song, you know, universal in its appeal.
Yeah. So the song that we've also been having success with on the station is Next Time.
Yeah.
Can you tell me what that song is about?
I introduced that song by saying this song tells the gospel truth about the biggest lie each of us tells ourselves. Because the song is about the fact that we all tell ourselves, oh, we'll get around to that next time. We'll do it next time. We won't do that next time. And that's a lie, because there is no next time. We got one time on this earth. And that song points out the irony of that statement in a way that I hope, you know, it starts out funny, but then it gets serious. And I mean, it starts out, you know, going to give up swearing and these goddamn cigarettes. I hope I can say that on the radio station.
Yeah, we're internet.
But then, but then it gets more serious about, you know, it becomes personal about a relationship. You know, I'm going to love you differently next time. And it ends with two simple words we tell ourselves, one simply perfect lie next time.
Yeah, that song's found a lot of success, but I think it's been, a lot of it's because of the lyric is just, it kind of takes you through all the emotions you feel about, you know, your life and trying to make something sense out of it.
Right.
Another good song on the album is the title track, The Side of the Dirt. Mm-hmm. What is that song about, and why did you choose it as the title track?
Well, I originally had thought about calling the album About Time, and I had written a song purpose-built to be that title of the album. And then, I mentioned that I coordinate the Washington, D.C. chapter of National Songwriters Association. So I'm always taking my songs that I'm working on to my group once a month. You know, it's like, hi, I'm Bob. I'm a recovering songwriter. Here's what I wrote this week. And that song resonated more with my group than About Time. And I was telling him about, you know, what I was thinking about the title for the album being About Time. And because I was thinking, oh, it's about time, because a lot of the songs deal with the theme of time and its preciousness, or the next time, etc. And it was about time Bob Klein got around to putting out an album of his own stuff. It was kind of the double meaning. But This Side of the Dirt just resonated with a lot of folks as a title idea. And they said, oh, that's what you should call your album. And I kind of test drove that with a few other people, including my producer, and everybody was in agreement. So I decided that that would be the title track. I did not put About Time on the album. Maybe it would be another album with that on it. But, so This Side of the Dirt, you know, talks about, you know, I've always loved that phrase. And certainly, you know, it talks about life and death.
That's a great imagery as well. How is this album different from whenever you go out and perform live? This is a full band album. Do you go out and perform normally as a band, or you go out just with guitar in hand? And
it's just usually me with a guitar and or a piano. I would say the only song I haven't played live by myself is Borrowed Time, which, because of this, that really complicated guitar riff, and the fact that it benefits from having backup singers sing the na-na-na part, which tracks the notes of the guitar riff. It's just something that's, at least I haven't figured out how to do that solo. I suppose I could do it without the riff, but I just would feel naked without it.
Wouldn't feel like the song, right?
yeah. But everything else I can do solo on guitar or piano or both.
Do you ever throw in covers when you go out and play live?
Oh, sure. I will occasionally, although we closed my release concert with a cover. We did the obligatory encore. I mean, who am I kidding? I couldn't wait to do an encore. And so one of my favorite rock songs of all time is Don't Stop Believing. And so we did that. Now, none of us on stage can sing in the key that Journey performs that song in. So we changed the key of it to suit our voices, and we did a really cool version of it that I basically adapted from a YouTube video I saw of the modern Journey band, with this kind of a breakdown section that's not on any, has different chords and lyrics that's not on any studio recording of that song. And I used that as an opportunity to thank the audience, thank the band members, and to get the audience engaged in a pretty insane sing-along at the end. Fortunately, I had a videographer there. I haven't gotten the video back yet, but so I had a two-camera shoot of the whole show, and I can't wait to view it in retrospect when I'm not in the moment.
Yeah, that'll be fun to see. You need to put that up on your website for sure.
Oh, yeah.
So here's my James Lipton question. I don't know if you know who he is, but
he's I do know who he is. I know exactly.
So this is my James Lipton question.
All right.
For you.
All right, James, go for it. Your voice is a little higher than I'm used to, James.
And I don't have the facial hair he has.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. What is your favorite song by somebody else and why?
Wow. Yeah. All right. Gee, I should have been prepared for that. What is my favorite song by somebody else? Gosh. Okay. I don't know that I could claim that any song is my favorite song. That would take a lot more thought than I have in these nanoseconds to consider. But certainly a song that I think touched me emotionally. And it's probably about the lyric about, well, first of all, let me say what the song is. It's The House That Built Me, performed by Miranda Lambert and written by Tom Douglas and Alan Shamblin, both phenomenal writers. And over the years, I've gotten actually to see each of them respectively perform that song live in different writers' rounds that I've witnessed that they were featured in during Ten Pan South down in Nashville. That song just connects a lot of emotional images that I think resonate with all of us. And for me, I have a little French bulldog, Cyrus, who's actually my music publishing company and record label are named after. It's Big Cyrus Music and Big Cyrus Records. He's a little 25-pound, 9-year-old French bulldog that thinks he's a Tyrannosaurus Rex. and I didn't know it was possible to be that much in love with a pet. I've never had a pet before. And so there's a line in The House That Built Me about my favorite dog is buried under that tree in your backyard, whatever the line is. And I that reduces me to tears every time I hear that line, because I just picture the day when I'm going to have to say that about Cyrus. And it's, I will be in therapy for years when that happens.
I understand that, yeah.
So that song connects with me. I mean, there are a lot of songs that connect. I mean, Hello in there, John Prine. It's a wonderful, wonderful song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there are so many great songs and great songwriters. It's hard to pick just one of
right.
my favorite. They all inspire me one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
They challenge me to be a better writer.
Yeah, songs like that, especially, just you like, how am I ever going to write anything that good, you know?
Yeah.
I feel that way about when I listen to Mary Chapin Carpenter. I'm just like...
I love her music, too.
How am I ever going to write as good as her?
Mm-hmm.
She just is just incredible. So what other musical plans do you have for the next year?
Well, thank Dan Navarro and my friend David Glazer and Chuck McDowell, they all suggested I join Folk Alliance, which mm-hmm. I did about a year ago, but I've not made it to any of the annual conferences. But I'm ticketed and all set, hoteled and everything, to go to the Montreal conference in February. So that'll be kind of the big industry event. In terms of personal performances, I mean, and of course, I plan on doing showcases there. And as between now and then, right now, I'm ramping up at my parish church for a big Christmas concert we do every year, and that's frankly occupying all my spare time. So I don't expect to do any Robert Dale Klein secular performances between now and the end of the year, although mm-hmm. if something comes up, I never say no to opportunities, but right now there's nothing on my schedule.
The Folk Alliance, you're going to be blown away by it. So
I hope to see you there. Will you be there?
I don't think I'm going to make it to Mount Montreal this year. That's just too far for us to go. But we usually go to Far West every year.
Mm-hmm.
And we go to several of the, we've been to several of the regionals. So maybe I'll see it at one of the regionals. I
look forward to it, Kathy.
Yeah. So I want to let everybody know they can find Robert Dale Klein's music at CD Baby, Amazon, and iTunes. And you can also friend him on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Anything else I'm missing out there on?
Well, if you come over to the house, I'll sing a song.
And the name of the album is This Side of the Dirt. It's a great album. You'll be touched by it, and it's just an inspirational album in a secular way, but still inspirational in every way.
Thank you very much, Kathy. It's very generous. I appreciate your airing it on your station. It's a wonderful reception that it's received.
Well, it's our pleasure. I'm Robert Dale Klein at robertdaleklein.com. Go check out his website, and you can also find some music there as well.
Yeah, I might say Klein is spelled K-L-E-I-N, for those of you who don't know German.
It's the German spelling of Klein.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, thank you again, Robert, and we'll be hearing more of you on KC Cafe Radio.
Thank you, Kathy.